Thank you. My name is James Love. I go by Jamie. I work in Washington, D.C. For an organization that has an office in Geneva and in Washington called Knowledge Ecology International. I'm going to talk about copyright infrastructure and access to protected and public domain works. The first topic I want to talk about was about formalities. It was something that a lot of people have talked about, particularly in the first day. And I think that there's a renewed interest in the idea that the lack of formalities in copyright, which is really introduced in the Berne Convention in 1908, is problematic in certain areas. And there's just, I'm going to just briefly go through in terms of the landscape of treaties, fairly technical issues about treaties and trade agreements as to where I think people are in terms of the flexibility they have in dealing with formalities issues. As you know, the key part of the Berne Convention people refer to is this Article 5, Paragraph 2. It says the enjoyment and exercise of the rights shall not be subject to any formality, and that's usually what people refer to when they say you just can't require formalities. Part of the strategy in dealing with formalities is to look for areas where, as Maria Pallente discussed before, you can create incentives for people to register by making it clear that some of the protections you have as an author will be stronger if you register. And that's generally the strategy that you have under the existing framework. Now, I make a reference here to the appendix to the Berne Convention. And in the appendix to the Berne Convention, under some of the compulsory licensing provisions that exist, there's an issue about whether or not you've done a due diligent request to identify the owner of the work. And this is an example of an area where, in an implementing legislation, a country could say, in the absence of a registration, the standards would be much lower in terms of determining whether or not somebody had done the diligent work. I mean, you sort of can create an environment where you have an incentive to register to make it more difficult for people to say that they just searched and couldn't find you. In the WCT, there's a specific clause that has to do with the obligations on rights management systems, which says that the contracting parties will not rely upon Article 12 of the WCT to create the effect of imposing formalities which are not permitted under the Berne Convention. So this is another area where it sort of pops up, which is to say that there's these new provisions in the WCT, and things are written a little bit differently, but they don't want you to sort of use the new article on rights management information to create this obligation. In the Rome Convention, on the other hand, there is no general barrier to using, for related rights, formalities. You can use formalities within the Rome Convention background for related rights. In fact, for any rights that's not sort of spelled out in the Berne Convention, that goes beyond what the Berne Convention did, as related rights do and some other extensions of what copyrights exist. You can actually introduce formalities for those things. In one particular clause in the Rome, they actually spell out the way that, something that should satisfy a formality request for phonograms. In the WCT, they PP, on the other hand, unlike the Rome, they actually come back to this idea that you can't have formality. So you're kind of, it's sort of back and forth on this. Now, in the TRIPS, I think what's really, to us, kind of, I think, a profound but important point is that before the TRIPS agreement at the WTO, in order to get the benefits of the Berne Convention, you had to join and sign the Berne Convention. Now, just by becoming a member of the WTO agreement, you get the benefits of the Berne Convention in terms of the foreign recognition of your rights and everything. What that essentially means is that the Berne Convention is really less important to you than the TRIPS agreement is. A TRIPS agreement is more important because it's enforceable and subject to dispute resolution, but also because it guarantees you this access to the recognition of the foreign author's rights. But that also brings some interesting things, because the TRIPS agreement has other things in it which modify the burn. And the question is, how do they do it? Now, one thing people normally look at is they look at the three-step test in Article 13, which relates to the copyrights. And I just want to point out very briefly that this only has to do with the provisions in the burn that have to do with the exclusive rights which are set out in terms of the exception to the exclusive rights, which is one area. But there are other things that you could make exceptions to other than the exclusive rights where this would be less problematic, or what other parts of the TRIPS would make a difference. Now, there's several other parts of the TRIPS which you just don't find in the burn, but you find in the TRIPS, like Article 1 is, you know, it sort of provides a certain degree of flexibility in terms of how you implement it. Article 6 I didn't spell out, but that's the one on the exhaustion of rights and the first sale doctrine. Article 7, Article 8, these things kind of provide a bigger background for the way the TRIPS operates, and they provide guarantees of more balance in the agreement, not just to the owners of the right, but to the users as well. In Article 8 of the TRIPS, which is on the, or Section 8, which is on the control of anti-competitive practices, this is quite important because it really says that some licensing practice involving intellectual property right, not only do they restrain competition and have adverse effects in different ways, but you can specify in your legislation practice that constitute abuse of intellectual property rights. So you have essentially also the opportunity to rein in intellectual property rights in these areas where you think that the contracts are unfair. So the basic strategy on formalities in some ways would be that you would, one thing you could do is you can require registration for terms that exceed the TRIPS minimum. So if the TRIPS says you have to have at least 20 years for photographs, or 50 years for some works and life plus 50 for some other works, but if your country has life plus 70, for example, or very long terms for photographs, you could say that sometime after the TRIPS requirement ends, you could impose something that did involve formalities. And that would not be inconsistent with the obligations in the Berne Convention. But more important, I think, is for a lot of works, is that the Berne Convention is silent on the issue of remedies. So it's possible to condition some remedies to registration of works or other formalities, as in practice many countries do now. The United States was talking yesterday how statutory damages are not available if you do not register the works, for example. In fact, in the United States, as Nick Ashnart was mentioning to me the other day, you can't get any money on a damage suit unless you register a work. So, you know, in theory, you can't have your rights are not supposed to be available, but in practice, and I think quite a few countries do have these registration systems, are often linked to your ability to remedy. And the Berne Convention doesn't have anything in it on remedies. And so you have a lot of flexibility in this area. On damages, there's a provision. I'm just going through a few other examples in damages. There's very lower standards in the TRIPS for someone that's an innocent infringer that doesn't really know they're infringing. Well, if you're looking at older works where you're not really sure if the person's alive or dead or when they died or things like that, you can sort of begin to kind of introduce the zone where if the work is not registered and if it's old enough, you could reduce the presumption that the person was a knowing infringer. Because if they had a reasonable expectation that the work was in the public domain because, you know, normal life expectancy, you know, was passed or something like that. I mean, you can sort of cut back and push back on some of these issues. Let's see if I can... Why it doesn't move. I think I have a quick comment. Okay. Whoops. All right. Okay. Sorry. Now, the injunctions provisions of the TRIPS are quite important, because the injunctions where you stop somebody from using your work. And in the TRIPS agreement, there was two different cases that I'm aware of that were probably derived from this provision in the TRIPS. One was that the United States, for government use in the United States, for all sorts of intellectual property rights, patents, plant breeder rights, copyrights, U.S. government does not allow you to get an injunction against it if it infringes on intellectual property, but you have a right to get paid. You have a right to some kind of compensation. And the U.S. had several other laws like that involving, for example, nuclear energy, where you couldn't get an injunction, but you could get paid. And some countries, like Canada and India and other countries, had laws that if you had an architectural plan infringed, you couldn't get an injunction once the building went up. And so what they did is they built into this TRIPS, this language here, it says that in some cases you can completely eliminate by statute the possibility of getting an injunction in terms where there's some, and the standard is adequate compensation or reasonable remuneration. So you have the possibility, in the case of remunerative rights, to essentially implement things in certain ways like that. And these can be things that can be really highly relevant to some of the proposals that people have identified. Now, I'm going to switch gears right now away from all this trade agreement stuff and talk about proposals and a proactive agenda people have to expand access to works. One is the idea that wonderful presentation on the Creative Commons in the last panel, which could have been much longer because it was so rich and so interesting and relevant, it reminds us that there's this big social movement towards sharing of works, and that major donors like the NIH in the United States or major universities like Harvard University or governments all over the world are looking at this idea of whether or not there should be more openness associated with grants that they give in terms of the scholarly works. And I think we all know that the free software movement has been extraordinarily effective. In fact, everyone in this room that's using an Android or an Apple phone or a Kindle is using some type of a Linux system on their computer, or probably the router in this room is. So it's become a very ubiquitous system under a free software licensing system. So these are actually major parts of the copyright infrastructure, and they use the copyright to insist on the viral sharing is how they do that. Now, the proposal is that authors should be able to centrally register and provide individual or blanket licenses to use works or various licensing strategies subject to the right of others to annotate the database with third-party rights to the same works. It would sort of, if you think of the current system, which is that the current system is that you kind of get an automatic copyright whether you want it or not. This would allow you to kind of reverse the field and sort of say, you know, I have kind of an automatic right to use under these general licenses. You get like a unique ID in the registry. And then if somebody wanted you to publish an article like in the British Medical Journal where I published something recently, I would then give them that ID and I would say, we'll work out our agreement, and then it would be up to the British Medical Journal to register that they had an exception to the general rule that everything I wrote was available for free going forward. And that would be that proposal. And then this slide is on reader rights. We talk a lot about author rights in this institution, but we believe that rights management systems should be implemented in ways that are least damaging to privacy, that Article 40 of the TRIPS permits governments to modify or refuse to enforce in digital rights management systems non-negotiated licensing terms, that enforcement mechanisms have obligations to provide fair and equitable procedures. That's actually an obligation in the TRIPS agreement. This proposal, and this is the conclusion now, is about two slides here. The matching fund proposal is an infrastructure proposal that works as follows. You create a mechanism to acquire global perpetual licenses for public access to electronic versions of works. You allow interested persons or organizations to propose as sellers or buyers to purchase the global public license. The intermediary accepts the matching fund pledges from people and aggregates that money up. And if the aggregation is high enough, then the purchase is made and you acquire the right, and it then becomes available to everyone for free. It's basically a buyout of the right. And an individual may only pledge like $1 or $5 or, you know, a relatively small amount of money. So the question is that collectively, could people get together and collectively propose that they sort of take something from the private element and make it into a public work of art or a public good in some way. The law and education open access fund set aside proposal is that you, through appropriations for acquisition of new goods, set aside 1 to 3% of the acquisition cost of new books and journals, and the money would be set aside into an open access fund, which could be spent only on the development of open textbooks, open databases, open academic journals, and global public licenses for ebooks. And this is the final one, the WTO agreement on the supply of public goods. There's discussions within the WTO over the idea of having an agreement in the WTO on the supply of public goods. The basic idea is that governments would make voluntary commitments to supply, to support the production or acquisition of knowledge as a public good. And once the commitments were made and listed on a WTO schedule, they would become enforceable under the WTO dispute resolution understanding or some set of modified rules. Thank you.